You're listening to Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I am Nick Folkman.
And I am Max Folkman. Today's guests are Ben Esposito and Andrew Schuldeis. Ben is a game designer, level designer, sound designer, artist, programmer, writer, and more, and has worked on titles such as Brooklyn Trash King, Bubsy 3D, Bubsy Visits the James Turrell Retrospective, The Unfinished Swan, What Remains of Edith Finch, Tattletale, and the recently released Donut County. He's also co-founder of Good City LA and Arcane Kids. Since leaving his job making hidden object games in 2015, Andrew has pretty much been the one-man developer behind Tunic, which may be released in 2019, or may not be.
I like those odds.
Thanks for coming on the show, you two.
It's a flip of the coin.
It's great to be here.
All right, Ben, we're going to start off things differently in this episode. I hit you with a hard-hitting question.
I've prepared myself. Okay.
We are now 2 years removed from your tweet that rocked game development Twitter, quote, "In game design, environmental storytelling is the art of placing skulls near a toilet." I'm laughing, but I'm genuinely curious to hear from both you, what are your thoughts on environmental storytelling today? Like, it is something that people joke about a lot, but it can be really effective.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, I think it's really funny to think about, because it's like, I love when there's a skull next to a toilet, right? That's like funny to me. And the things I'm referring to when I talk about that are like, you know, these kind of like expensive and really environment heavy games. Like, I think Fallout 3 was that was like making a reference to Fallout 3. And I love the way they do storytelling and make it kind of a joke in that game, because like, maybe it's because I'm an insider. I can tell designers like made a space and then were trying to figure out what's the funniest thing they could do with the tools they had. And so skeletons are obviously like the most efficient way of telling a human story after the fact. And so it's all about like, how can we place these two skeletons in a bathtub or whatever to like get them, like wring the most out of the space. So I think there's a huge range of things you can do with it. And I think humor is honestly like one of the better things you can do with environmental storytelling.
Like, I agree about humor being a really strong use of environmental storytelling. Like, to me, Portal is one of the best examples of that, with the hidden stories, like when you go behind the walls of the testing facilities.
Right.
Everything through there. But I think like everything else, it can be done poorly. It's like, it's not always a bad thing. It's not always an amazing thing. It just, the bad examples to me jump out when it's just like, you look at graffiti on a wall somewhere, and it's like, why would this person who's getting killed write this stuff about the weakness of an enemy when they're about to die? Like, what, why aren't they taking care of themselves first?
There's got to be better uses for that blood.
Yeah.
Right. There's like obviously cliches. I don't know. It's like anything else. There's cliches. You get used to it. And then the cliches kind of like come around the corner to the point where like you see a piece of graffiti and you already expect to see what it's going to say, which is really annoying, but that also kind of opens it up for subverting, you know, people's expectations. So it's kind of like a cycle that'll keep going, but I don't know, there's not a lot of people doing a great job with that in particular.
Dicey, do you have any thoughts on environmental storytelling?
Yeah, I guess so. It's from what you guys are saying, it sounds like maybe the ideal form is where it's, I guess, environment first that happens to tell a story, as opposed to like sometimes when you see the, you know, the graffiti on the wall that's giving you an important fact, it sounds like it's coming from a place of, we need to get this fact about the world across, and so we'll use the environment to tell this story, as opposed to building an environment that is convincing in its own right that happens to have facts that tie back to the story. So you're you know, maybe this is just, it's a skeleton bathtub factory and, you know, fill in the blanks.
No, yeah, that's a good point. Like, I think it's, you can use it for exposition and it's like, can be done in a really efficient way that sometimes adds to it. Like, I feel like Dead Space did a good job of that. Like at the very beginning when you're like learning about the monsters and there's like that bloody room.
Yeah.
I thought that was actually awesome. But yeah, like in terms of what would interest me, I think having a space with its own logic that you can kind of like follow through and see like, oh, right, someone would have hid here. And oh, that's kind of surprising, like what they put there. Like as long as it's internally consistent, then it's cool.
There's some cases where once you've sort of bought into the idea that, all right, I'm playing a video game and I'm here to experience a story, there is a certain amount of fun to going into whatever, this vault in Fallout or what have you, and trying to piece together the story as it's being written, like sort of trying to suss out what the puzzle is. By finding these little snippets of story. And that's, you know, acknowledging the like designer player relationship a little bit, but that happens in video games a lot anyway. So that's a more like, I guess, writing centric way to do that well.
Right. Yeah. It's the kind of Disneyland thing where everything's like hand placed for you to unfold, and you can do it out of order, but you know, there's level design kind of dictates the order you do things in general. So yeah, I think people are used to seeing like the signifiers of story. And so when they like walk into a room, they're like, oh, there's an environmental story here. And that's when they're mad about it. So like, I really like the idea of like abstracting that further and just instead of having, you know, like the graffiti writing or the blood on the wall, just have like an abstract story coin or something that you can go and pick up. And then it says like, oh, you learned more about the story and your like XP bar goes up. And maybe your character knows about the story, but you, the player, don't need to know it because it's just an abstract concept of collecting story. That's like, I want to do that in a game.
Are there many games I've done that you play?
No, because it'd be too much of a joke. Because it is
like
a joke.
You could do like a Dear Esther sort of thing where the story just unfolds as you visit places. But I guess that's not really environmental storytelling. That's just storytelling in an environment.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. Yeah. I mean, I think maybe what people react to also is how like elevated the concept of environmental storing is. Like it's been lauded as like, oh yeah, it's the goal is like every tiny bit of your environment has to be telling a story that is relevant to, you know, the overall arc of the game. But I mean, I don't know, it's a tool like anything else. I like games that take place in an abstract world of triangles and stuff. Like it doesn't really matter. There's no hierarchy of like, oh, that's the highest form of game narrative.
Yeah. And to me, it's like you wouldn't always want the environment telling the story. Like it depends on the story you're trying to tell. But at certain points, if you're in the story and you want like the player to focus on a certain thing, having a story going on in the environment would detract from their attention and would probably break up what you want to get across in some way.
That's a good point. Like imagine having infinite story density to your video game where like you can keep zooming in on like a smaller and smaller area, but it still has like traces of story. You can zoom in on like a particle and you can
it's like the opposite of everything where you're just like going into like the writing on a subatomic particle. Like what's their story that's going on? What's their day-to-day life? There's a skeleton on that subatomic particle too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Imagine how horrible that game would be.
Like that'd be good for one case, but you couldn't do that for every game.
Right. It's like so not desirable to me too.
Yeah.
Like the idea of like walking into a game and being like, wow, there's an infinite amount of things that I won't see or understand about this game. Like there's always like a balance, I think, of like I want to understand most of it and have a little bit of it remain a mystery at the end.
And to me, like that concept you just described, that would work way better for a comedic game than like anything verging on drama, because I feel like the weight of it would break the drama, where a comedic can bend so much with what that game is trying to do. You could play around with it way more.
Right, yeah, you can have it be absurd.
Yeah. I think that's enough on environmental storytelling for now, so we'll get into the real questions. Andrew, how did you get into making games?
I got into games by, I think, probably checking out a bunch of books on BASIC from my local library that were super out of date when I got them, but it was good enough. I didn't even realize that I could use them. Like, it was just sort of this, like, you can tell a computer what to do. That's neat. I didn't realize that I had QBASIC installed on my 386 until a little while later. That was a revelatory moment. I've sort of been tinkering around with computers and programming ever since. You know, sometimes making games, sometimes not. But yeah, here we are now, using computers to make video games. Living the life.
Awesome. How'd you get in, Ben?
I always wanted to make video games ever since I got I got a Game Boy, and I got a Link to the Past. Oh, Link's Awakening, sorry. And Link's Awakening was just like this master key or this master lock to video games where I spent like a year not knowing how to play it because I was too young. And then like over the course of 5 years, I got the skills needed to like figure it out. So that had always been my kind of like, that's the ultimate mystery and the ultimate like form of a video game is like growing up with it. So I knew I always wanted to make games. And then in high school, I was like tinkering around and like I learned BASIC and I moved on to like Flash because the like internet was kind of exploding with Flash games. And so I started getting into Flash and then I got into I got sucked into Counter-Strike, started modding for Counter-Strike and making levels for my friends and stuff, and then modding for like Half-Life 2, etc., etc. And then I wasn't sure I'd be able to get into the game industry, but I graduated college with kind of this like degree in everything where it was like I did art and I did a music class and I also took communications and writing classes and I did have a minor in programming. And so I was like, I don't know if I can get a job, but maybe. So I looked, I saw a post about this game called The Unfinished Swan. And I looked at the prototype video and I was like, oh my God, I want to work on that. So I sent them a resume and I made a little game for them to be like, hey, look what I can do. It's a game that just you play it and it's kind of uses the same mechanic. But when you reveal stuff in the environment, it just says like, I'm Ben Esposito. I love to make really good levels and I love to work with cool people. And they were just like, oh, OK, come fly to Los Angeles and start making games. And so that was like my first gig.
Before you got that gig, like what? You want to work in games, what did you want to do? Did you want to like make games yourself? Did you want to just be like a level designer or a programmer or what?
Oh, I wanted to be a designer for sure. Okay. Like I had a million ideas and the idea of like being a specialist was like really freaky to me. That like made me kind of sad and depressed to think about. But wow. I was, because I like more high level tasks. I like, you know, designing like an overall experience and I love coming up with, you know, an entire concept, like the theme and the mechanics. And I also like doing all the details too. So that's why I ended up making a big game by myself.
And Andrew, like when you were starting out, what did you think you wanted to do? Like, did you always want to make games?
Yeah, I guess so. Like I remember saying, I'm going to make video games to like my next door neighbor when I was just a tiny little kid. And he said, well, you need to move to Japan to do that. And you need a special thing so you can put the games on cartridges. I was like, oh man, dreams ruined. Can't ever be a game designer. And so, yeah, I guess, I mean, I took a similar path to you, Ben, you know, tinkering around in BASIC and then Flash for a little while. Mm. Didn't get into Counter-Strike, but
you're missing out, man.
Yeah, is there still time?
It's still like really, really popular game for some reason.
I feel like my old man reflexes would not be competitive in that space. But messed around and like glut for a little while before eventually landing on Unity, which Ben, you're using as well, I assume.
Yeah, my stuff. Yeah. Is mostly in Unity.
I think we're gonna go like to more general outlook on story because you two are both really interesting. They're mostly one-man studios and you're both deal with story but not like are heavily story focused. So I'd like to hear from both of you, what do you think the role that story should serve in a game is? Like, is it subservient to gameplay? Do they work hand in hand? Does it change game to game?
You're up, Dicey.
Oh, okay, sure. I think it totally depends on the game. Like sometimes the story is absolutely everything. Sometimes you're just sort of dissecting a story very slowly, and sometimes it's given to you very directly, and sometimes you need to work at it like a. Even in a Her Story sense, you're reading something out of order, but the story is the content, and that's cool and valuable, and that's a great game. But you know, there are definitely other games where there's basically zero story, and that's still okay as well. You know, Go doesn't really have much of a story. I haven't read up on the lore or anything like that. But I think that there's, I personally am more attracted to games that have either a story that's delivered to you or is implied or that you need to hunt down.
Did you know that you wanted a story in Tunic from the beginning?
I guess so. It's weird because Tunic is sort of started as what is the story of the player's experience, which is sort of weird and maybe a little bit too like heady, but you know, what is the experience of the player going in and exploring a world where they don't understand all the rules and they feel like they're a stranger in the strange land, and you know, they're lonely and they feel like they don't belong. And a side effect of that is usually that there is the feeling that there is some sort of like greater story happening that you can't quite fully understand. So the story, such as it exists in Tunic, is, I guess, sort of a byproduct of trying to capture that feeling of not quite fully understanding what's going on in the world.
Have you felt obligated to make it bigger than you would want to?
I mean, the game in general, I guess so, yes. As far as...
like the story's importance. Like, do you think players expect a certain amount of story, or are you trying to push back against that?
That's a good question. Sometimes people ask about, you know, like, are there going to be NPCs? Am I going to be going on side quests? Am I going to be, is there going to be dialogue? And like, no, not really. It's not really that kind of game. But I do sometimes get, you know, self-indulgent about, you know, backstory and the truth behind the world. And I mean, maybe it's, you know, too much of a peek behind the curtain, but the, when that is left, when that is presented ambiguously, but fully considered behind the scenes,
yeah.
I feel like what you're left with often is something that feels big, but is maybe like a little bit bigger than it is actually, because there are gaps that you fill in with your imagination. I mean, it's like that, you know, the horror movie trope, I think, applies in a lot of cases where, you know, if you have a ground truth, but only show glimpses of it, the audience's imagination is going to be probably more powerful than anything you can provide for you. And plus it feels more exciting to fill in those gaps and have it feel like you've got a little bit of ownership over something, as opposed to just, you know reading a wall of text, at least in this game. I hope at least.
And Ben, when we met you, I remember that you said there was not any story in Donut County.
Oh yeah, way back.
So how did you come up, like, when did you decide that you wanted to put one in?
It was, I always knew there, I wanted like some kind of consistency to like what was going on. I wanted it to be all kind of all over the place in terms of like how surprising each scene is. But I found that like that amount of freedom for me was making it really hard to work on the game. So the trying to come up with a reason to put everything into this world together kind of necessitated like a little bit of a story. And then once that took a foothold, like I was just gone. Like I had to answer every single question about like, why are the holes here and who's moving them? Are they like sentient, et cetera, et cetera. But on one hand, it got a little bit out of control, but on the other hand, I'm really happy with how it turned out. And I think that actually helped me like figure out not only like the flow of the game, but like the actual puzzles and locations of the levels and like what they would look like. So like having that, building this like big consistent world from the ground up, did pay off in a certain way. I don't know if it's what people wanted, but I saw that concept through to the end because I felt like I had to. So yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm at a little bit of a crossroads with story in games, because I feel like on the one hand I'm happy with what I did in terms of putting the story into Donut County, and I think people do appreciate it, but I think there's also another group of people that were disappointed by how important the story was versus like the level of mechanical complexity. And so now I'm kind of just like, where should I really be doing this? I don't know. Like, do people really want a story in a game like this? Does it have to be a story-fied genre? I'm not sure. I'm trying to figure that out now.
Right. Do they think that because there's story in the game, that takes away from, like, if there was no story, that means there would have been more puzzles, more mechanics?
Maybe. It's possible. I think, like, there's people who just liked the concept of the game and did not find the story funny or interesting, and thought that the story was stopping them from enjoying the game because they have to click through all the things. Like, it's not optional, because I don't really think in a plot and story heavy game the story should necessarily be optional. Like,
yeah,
you might as well not do it if people are going to skip it, right? So that's kind of why I'm like, oh, I made it so people can't skip it, but some people were like very unhappy about that. Not a large majority of people, but yeah, I don't know. It was a lot of work to do it, and so I'm just like, huh, I don't know what my next experiment in story will really be.
You kind of went into it a bit, but like, it sounds like the role story serves in a game for you is it gives context to the gameplay and connects everything together and makes people care about what they're doing in a game.
Yeah, I mean, I think games are so broad that like you can't say like, oh, story has this one use in all of games, unless you like make a really, really broad statement. But in terms of what I was trying to do and what I kind of like in general is when the story like glues the whole game together and also adds in a deeper kind of like explanation and meaning to what's actually going on in a way that really enriches and like multiplies the meaning behind all the verbs, or like the tension between what's happening in terms of the action and like what the like emotional quality of it is. So like Donut County is all about like the kind of bittersweetness of like, oh, it's supposed to be fun, but you know, it's also horrible and you're destroying everyone's homes and throwing them in a hole. And so there's kind of like that, I was trying to ride that like bittersweet line the entire time. And I think the story helped push that a little bit further, in terms of having characters kind of assigned to like the different perspectives on it. But yeah, I don't know. Did I need it? I'm not sure.
I liked it. Right before we started recording, I was reading, Emily Short wrote a blog post about Donut County. And then in the comments, one guy talked about how he enjoyed that, unlike Katamari Damacy, which is a person like, but he felt uncomfortable with the idea that there was no consent with the things that were being rolled upon. And he liked that. And Donut County, like, it interrogated that, like, it's kind of messed up that I'm putting these people in holes. And it's like acknowledging that. And so,
oh my God, that's great.
Yeah. And like, you wouldn't have that if there was no story.
That's a good point. Yeah. I actually, one of the funny things that came up that was kind of related to this game was like, did you play Mario Odyssey?
Yes. Yeah.
I think Mario Odyssey blew my mind because it's a game all about possessing people and possessing like other characters. But there is like, and there's a story, but there is not like a single actual reference to what it means to possess someone else. It's like completely not questioned in the entire game. Like there's only one like nod at the very beginning to like, huh, you're kind of just taking this body over and then discarding it. And when I played that game, I was like, I didn't know you could make a game where you don't answer the question, what does it mean to do this? It freaked me out because I was like, my whole game is about answering the question, what does it mean to put everyone in a hole? But, you know, maybe I didn't have to do that.
People had fun interrogating the ramifications of Cappy, though, when the game came out.
Yeah, that's true.
So a question for both of you that's related to this. When you're making a game, how early are you thinking about theme or like what a game is quote unquote about?
I guess from the very beginning, at least for me, or I guess any game, like a jam game or anything like that, the like emotional payload for me at least is sort of the reason for making it. Like, how do you want to make someone feel when you're making a thing? And sometimes that changes. Like I've made jam games where that feeling has evolved over the course of making it. And then with this larger project, the question of how do you want someone to feel and what do you want them to take away from it is also becomes a deeper question as you go. Like there's a certain amount of, oh, it's a game about, you know, running around and feeling, you know, this sunshiny adventure time sort of let's go kill some monsters and go into caves sort of feeling gives way to like, but why? Why are you doing that? What is the next step? Like, what is the, cause I'm not especially good at writing stories. I find that the process of like thinking about constituent components and how they fit together in a timeline, like, I don't know, my brain is just not wired for it properly, I don't think. And so, when you come down to, well, what if it's not just about this momentary feeling. It's an evolution of that feeling for someone who's playing a game for, you know, hours and hours, as opposed to like looking at a picture for a few seconds. That becomes much more complicated. And I guess maybe in some ways I'm still working that out with this game. But yeah, it's definitely an important part of the process for me, and it's, I guess, still a challenge that I deal with.
Do you ever do it reverse, where you have this kind of like top-down theme that you're kind of interested in exploring, and then try to answer like, how does that make you feel? Or does it always come from like emotion first?
I guess, yeah, it depends on what you mean by feel. Because sometimes it's about like a kinesthetic experience. Like sometimes it is, what is this feeling like? Or what is, you know, the excitement of moving through this space? That's definitely, a place to start. But I guess maybe that's still like, that's the goal feeling. That's the sort of like the thing that you want to inject into someone's brain is this cool, nice feeling. But I guess sometimes that's a more moment to moment kinesthetic thing, and more, sometimes it's more of a more like a moodier, long-term thing.
What about you, Ben Haller?
I don't know, man. Sorry. Like, it's always different. I'm a lover of like the aesthetic qualities in games and the theming, from, you know, the genre to the art style to the way it sounds and the way the menus look and the way they move around and the timing of getting between menus and the timing of actions and stuff. Like all that stuff is like interesting in its own right to me. So sometimes I like go down that rabbit hole. And I think in Donut County, I certainly did that, where like I really didn't need to overdo all the like UI elements to make them kind of work. But in my head, I had this idea that like, oh yeah, the UI is what raccoons use to navigate the raccoon app in this game. And so it has to have this theme of like garbage chic. And so it has to have these like this like kind of elegant-ish typeface, but also like have this kind of beautiful trash color swirling around type of thing to it. So I let that kind of guide me into places that maybe I didn't need to go, but I think it's kind of fun for the texture of the overall experience. But yeah, I've done it in a number of ways. Like a lot of like the Giant Sparrow games kind of start with a theme and an idea and a feeling and zero mechanics. And so in the case of like Edith Finch, that type of game is really challenging to make because you know what it's about. And then you have to come up with a game that matches that feeling. And you have all these other constraints on you. Like that game in particular, we wanted to do like tons of stories, and we wanted the controls to be really simple and intuitive. And we didn't want to reuse anything because that's boring. So it was a kind of a challenge to pull out all these different mechanics that kind of exist around this feeling or kind of like evoke different like facets of this, that type of a experience of like nature overwhelming you. And so like that was really fun but extremely difficult and tedious to do. I don't know if I want to do another like kind of story and feeling first game yet, because it's a big deal to kind of like wrap your head around it, and there's a lot of experimentation involved. So yeah, I'm trying to actually swing the other way and start with like a mechanic or something that I think is going to be really fun, and then figure out how to theme it in like not a corny way, but I like the idea of just like taking a game mechanic and like fully theming, dressing it up and doing a song and dance to make you really happy. Like, I don't think there's anything like inauthentic about doing that. So I'm like interested in the making a facade for something. That's my kind of next idea.
Isn't that kind of what happened with Donut County though? Because didn't that start with the Peter Molyneux tweet?
Well, it started with, yeah, you play as the hole in the ground, but I never made that into a real game. The hole in the ground is like kind of a mechanic, and the puzzle things are kind of mechanics, but every level is basically a one-off in terms of, they're more, I'd compare it more to an adventure game, where like you go into a level and then the puzzle is based on what the level, like the actual content of the level is supposed to be. And so everything in that game is like handmade to happen once. And like I repeat some things a few times, but they're all totally like specifically tailored for like one specific level.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have a system per se.
Okay. But thematically, the game did change a lot from what it was originally.
Oh, yeah. It certainly did.
I had no idea the game was about Native American culture before.
Yeah, it was, well, because it was like, I like had that mechanic, and then I was like, oh, what does it mean to put people in the hole? And then I was like, oh, right, this is a game about erasure. And I was like, ooh, how does this like fit into like a real world kind of like story that has elements of like the natural world and people that are falling in and scale? And I was like, oh, yeah, this like Native American theme really fit in my mind. Also, I mean, this was back in like 2012, and I worked on it, and I kind of got to this place where I realized like some of the ethical problems with trying to tell the story I was trying to tell. And I tried to kind of go down. I tried to like kind of push through it and figure out the right way to do it until I kind of realized there was no right way to do it. So I had to kind of figure out how to take what I had and tell the same kind of a story with a similar theme, but like figure out, you know, my perspective on it. And that's how I ended up with Donut County.
Related to the theme, ask me what we were talking about and like shifting the theme during development. Andrew, has the theme for Tunic shifted at all, or has it been pretty solid from like beginning to where it is now?
Yeah, I'd say that it's changed a little bit, without necessarily getting into spoilery details or anything like that. The spirit of the game originally was, you know, what is it like to, I guess the best way to put it is that it's gone from everything is sunshine and fun times to maybe there are spookier things in the world. And that's been sort of a weird change to internalize in some ways, because, you know, and on the outside it is, you're a little fox and you're running through the countryside and it looks nice. And I think the thing that sometimes people walk away from the demo with is, this is hard. Like this makes me feel like I don't belong. And I guess that has been something that is, I guess was there from the beginning, but has maybe come into its own a little bit more clearly in my mind. That is part of the feeling of feeling like you don't really understand everything that's going on around you is accomplished by having things that don't want you there and feeling like you are something of an intruder.
It sounds tight.
We'll see.
For both of you, when you're wearing so many different hats and have so much knowledge of game development and what's possible and what your capabilities are, do you feel like this gives you more freedom when you're coming up with a story, or does it feel more restrictive?
I think freedom is a really terrible thing for an artist. At least in my own experience. Like, I think gaining more skills at development and having such a breadth of skills as well, like, makes it harder and harder to make something or decide what to make. Because, like, I don't know, I found it a lot easier when I was first starting, because I would be so limited by my technical skills that I was like, oh, well, how the heck do I, like, make an experience or tell a story given this handful of tools? I have some squares. I can make this one turn on and off. I can move this block. And that was like so much easier because the constraints dictated that like I had to come up with kind of like clever ways to, you know, make it work. But
yeah,
when I have the like, when I have Unity open in front of me and I'm like, well, I could make that thing. That would take like a week. And then I could do that thing. That would take a week. And then I have no idea whether or not it's a good idea because I could do 10 other things that might also be great. So yeah, I found like having some constraints on the games I've worked on have helped a lot. Mostly time constraints have helped a lot. but you know, like having, I think, yeah, going forward, having more like actual design constraints on what I can actually do would probably help a lot, help mitigate that problem of having too much freedom, because it's been a real challenge.
Are there like any skills you wish you didn't know?
I don't know, it's kind of like, it's always a blessing and a curse, right? I feel like I'm so cursed with like my interest in all these different categories, because it's not efficient to do things by yourself. Like, I really don't think it's, I think working with someone can like multiply both of your skills and what you're able to do. So it does kind of feel like a curse that I've chosen to kind of like be proficient at a bunch of stuff.
Do you agree, Andrew?
Yeah, that constraints are good for artists. Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned it before, but I made hidden object games a long time ago, and it wasn't a huge team, but there was a lot of, like, you know, we suffered from like pipeline issues, like, oh, you know, the artists aren't ready, or the programmers don't have anything to do, or the artists don't have anything to do. And so part of me was just like, God, I, you know, game jams are fun. What if I just did a game jam for months and months and months, and everything will be fine. I'll just work at maximum capacity always, and it'll be great. And I at least had the forethought to know that audio is something that can be tidally siloed. And as much fun as I find making audio stuff, I knew that, you know, professionals would be required. So there's Power of Audio is doing the audio for the game, and Terrence Lee Lifeformed is doing the soundtrack. But other than that, production-wise or development-wise, I thought, like, I can handle this. And yeah, it's you can get into real, like, vortices of of second-guessing yourself. And it that sort of thought process highlights, for me at least, what my weaknesses are and where I end up spinning my tires and when I end up redoing stuff. And like Ben, you said, one of the side effects of starting something and it taking a long time is that you get better and better at the things that you do every day. And so you look back at the stuff that you did at the beginning and you're like, what if I just redid everything? Wouldn't that be awesome and fun? And I've scrapped so much content in my game because I realized that I didn't have it fully thought out, or all these pieces didn't fit together just right. And I feel like working with other people can actually help in those sorts of scenarios. And at the very least, some other people that are helping out with this game are Finji, the publishing house with Adam and Becca Saltzman. And one of the biggest sort of boosts to my productivity is sitting down and talking to Adam for a couple hours every week and just saying, here's what I'm thinking, here's what I'm going to be working on. And just having another human being who has the sort of like the design of the game in their mind and, you know, has enough, like there's enough of the design now externalized into his brain as well that I can't just throw it all away and say, no, that was a terrible idea, that thing that I worked on for a week. This new, much better thing is what I'm going to do now. Just knowing, it's like, no, I told Adam I would be working on this. And he said, that's a good idea for these reasons. I'm like, right, okay, good. And that's just talking to another human boosting my productivity. I can imagine I do in some ways look back with fondness on the days where you can sort of hand off this hard task to a professional and have them go and do a good job and come back and say, oh, great. Like the thought of work being done that I didn't do myself and just is, yeah, it's been a long time. And that's what's cool about working with PowerUp is it's whenever there's new stuff added, it's sort of magical. It's like I come back in the morning. It's like, wow, this project did work on itself.
No, that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think you solved, I think with Finji and, you know, specifically talking to Adam about the design, like you solved one of the hardest problems that at least I faced working on Donut County, which is that there was no one else. Like there are other people who were invested in the project, but I didn't have like a confidant who also knew what I was trying to do, who I could get like even just like a gut check against. And that was so challenging because, you know, there's these forking paths in front of you. And, you know, you also have your emotional state, which kind of like urges you to do the opposite of whatever you did when it failed, which is not always the right thing to do. So I'm impressed with, you know, the kind of like workflow that you have going.
Hopefully it ends up working out in the end. I remember I complaining a long time ago about, and I used this weird analogy where I felt like I was in a, like, imagine an infinite plane, infinite featureless plane. And as far as the eye can see in every direction are like these cranks on the ground. and they're really hard to move, but you can go up and you can crank any one of them and make progress, but who knows which is the right one, you know? Ever since being able to have a gut check is a good way of putting it, Ben. Having someone who, you know, is like, no, this is the right crank. You can, yeah, go in this direction.
Keep going.
Yeah, I guess a better analogy is being like lost in the woods and just knowing, like, I can't see where I'm going, but I know that this is the right direction because, you know, I thought about it and I double checked. The map says this is the right way, so let's go this way.
Right, yeah, that is super, super nice. Because it does feel like that making a sizable project when you're kind of responsible for it. Like, you're just, it's like a fully faith-based endeavor. You just have to kind of believe that it's going in some direction.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, anybody who's, I think anybody who's made a thing before in their life knows that that can be a really challenging feeling, or a challenge is to believe in yourself and be able to look at what you did and look at a work in progress and say, yeah, this is a means to an end and will be good in the end.
You gotta tell yourself.
Dicey, do you work from home?
I do, yeah.
Okay, so then, Ben, did you work out a glitch? Did you get a lot of input from other glitch people on your game? Or it sounds like you didn't.
I think, you know, I would do like playtests with people of levels, which was definitely necessary in terms of like doing puzzles or light puzzles. But I didn't have anyone in particular who was kind of like invested in the project to a degree where like they were, I was able to kind of like regularly talk to them about the design challenges I was facing. And maybe, you know, that was my fault for not kind of like reaching out and trying to establish that relationship with someone else. But I also felt like it's so time consuming and expensive and like emotionally expensive to be invested in someone else's project that way, that I was like, ugh, I kind of feel bad asking people to like give up a few hours a week to hear me kind of ramble about all my problems. But I think, you know, maybe some way you can do it, some way I have found is kind of useful to do it going forward, is to have like a reciprocal kind of like advisor role with someone else where you do that for each other's projects, and you can say like, hey, I'm invested in yours the same way you are in mine, and I'm going to be honest with you about like the directions that I see you're going, and because I want you to succeed. And that's like kind of the only way it makes sense to like spend so much time helping someone and the pain.
Do you think the game would have been a lot different if you had worked from home?
It wouldn't have gotten done. I couldn't focus at all at home. I mean, this might just be a personal, more of a personal preference thing, but I find it really difficult to stay motivated and like feel like I'm actually doing work if I'm at home. Like, I think the ritual of just like entering a different space or a different office, like actually traveling there, I was able to kind of trick myself into working. But like at home, I would start working for like 5 minutes and then start cleaning, and then when I was done cleaning, I would start eating snacks and et cetera, et cetera. And I kept finding new things to add onto that list.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, this is not working for me. But I know some people are able to do it.
Like Andrew, is it hard to stay motivated at home and do work?
There, the like snacks and house cleaning are basically my two favorite things. sometimes it is challenging. I have to, like you said, Ben, the ritual of entering another space is really powerful. And I don't really have that. I've got sort of an office, but it's multipurpose, so it's hard to like truly get away and be like, here's a space where I only do work. Mm. So I use a system where I do like time boxing. I start a timer and it's like, no, I'm working and I have to log it meticulously. And it's like 50% for production data where I can look back and find out like, oh, this is what I was working on and this is where I spent my time. And it's 50% just a way to make sure that I'm focused for an amount of time.
That's a nice technique.
And I want to backtrack to like 10 minutes ago when Andrew, you were talking about like making something a while back, then redoing it one or two more times. How do you know when you're finished with something, whether it's a story beat or a level or a character model or whatever?
I don't know, because my game isn't done yet, and so it's I'm definitely no part of it is done. So maybe this is a better question for Ben.
That's really funny. Yeah, like you. I mean, the best answer is that you ran out of time, right?
Yeah.
That's the only way to know for sure that you are done, is that you can't physically work on it anymore.
Or you can't afford to work on it anymore.
Or you can't afford to work on it anymore. Right, right. But yeah, no, I think it's difficult to know when that is true, because it's hard to have like a rubric for if something is good enough in a project, especially when, you know, when it's so large. So like I had kind of a moving benchmark for this, where I would make one level and that was like the best level that I had made. And I said, okay, everything has to be at least this good or close to this. And then I would do that. I'd bring up all the, you know, levels quality to that level. And then I would keep moving forward on the game. And then I'd end up making a level that was like more detailed, more interesting, like had more stages to it. And then I was like, oh, okay, this is the benchmark. And then I'd go back and do that for everything else. And then eventually I ran out of time and I was like, oh, cool. Okay. These are totally done because I played them and they're fine. So I definitely struggled with figuring that out. And I probably made things a little more polished than I needed to, but you know, part of that was for me, and the other part was because I didn't really have a hard deadline for the game, and I found it really hard to kind of self-enforce like a time when I was going to be done, because I didn't really have anything really pressing on me until I started working with Annapurna Interactive. And we were talking and they're like, okay, so you're going to get the game done around this time, right? And I was like, yeah, sure. And then it became so much easier to work on the game, because I was like, okay, cool. This has to be done. This is done. This is done. This is done. And then if not, and if something like felt significantly worse than that, I had to bolster it. So, you know, next time I would probably have a more rigid or aggressive schedule, because I think there's actually a drawback to like over polishing stuff in general. And I think I definitely hit the point of like diminishing returns in terms of polish on my game. So that's a lesson learned.
Lesson learned as well. I'm gonna
take that to heart. To add an extra thought, I've been having this conversation a lot with a lot of people, but like, I think it was me and Thomas Astle who was making Wobble Dogs, and we were saying that you can tell when someone hasn't figured out the design of their game yet if they have one random detail that's like way too polished. That's like the mark of someone who's like struggling with figuring out what their game is, and I was totally guilty of that too. When you look and you're like, wow, how come that detail is so amazing and so striking? And that's all that we can see of this game. And I'm like, oh man, that's exactly like, that was my problem 100%. So like, you can kind of tell, like, because you know, when you're like by yourself, you like, I don't know if you experienced this, yeah, like if I would get stuck with like a big question about what the game was going to be, I'd be like, well, I have to make progress, so I guess I will make the water effect better. And I just kept doing that over and over. It's like eating snacks or cleaning up. I'm just like,
yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I'll make this better. And so it's funny to kind of see it in like videos of other like indie games and stuff. I'm like, yeah, I know that struggle.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way of putting it. That was definitely me for like, you know, a year at least.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Recently this has changed actually, because there ended up being a design reason why I needed to implement it. But Felix Kramer, who's helping with sort of like keeping me on track and doing biz dev stuff, forbade me from adding little particles beneath your feet when you ran around and did a dodge, because they said like, that is definitely a thing that you need to add, but you will, and you've got better things to do right now.
So you're not allowed to add them yet.
Yeah, well, no, I ended up having to do it because they were just like, well, we need to show when you've got iframes and when you don't, and this is probably the best thing to do. So we needed to go back well, on sure. that. But yeah, there's definitely examples of, and you know, sometimes I do, I mean, often, I guess, indulge myself when I'm having trouble with something. This is actually an observation that I had a little while ago, and maybe it's being like, well, I sometimes you just really need snacks, and that's self-care. maybe it's that, but sometimes when I'm frustrated with how something is going, and I think, well, I don't really understand how this, you know, like this area is supposed to feel, or I don't know how all the mechanics are supposed to work together in this area, I should indulge that desire to polish and make something that has a like, I don't know, I guess like an aesthetic voice, like something that that makes you look at it and be like, oh wait, I sort of understand how these things move, or like it, you know, making an enemy that is an abstract box can answer some design questions sometimes, but more often than not you need to you know, design and model and make that enemy move before you really understand what it's I don't know what it's like, its physical presence in the world is like, and how that informs the design. I don't know. The fact that I can't fully articulate this makes me think more that it is, oh boy, snacks.
I learned this from Brendan Chung, which is like, Brendan works on his games mostly by himself. And that's what he told me he does whenever he's stuck, is he just like turns off whatever he was doing and then adds one really like self-indulgent detail to the game. And it like totally, you can tell when you play his games, like where the self-indulgent details were and the shortcuts were. And it's just like, actually I find it super charming. So I'm like, maybe this isn't the worst thing, but yeah, no, I totally agree with, sometimes figuring out, you know, more of the like aesthetic or polished qualities actually gives you a hint as to what you're supposed to do in the design or at a systems level. Like just kind of like saying, you know, oh, here's the silhouette of this thing will give you ideas about like, oh right, I didn't think it could move that way, but because of the, you know, because I answered this artistic question, it actually informed, you know, the way this thing moves, or, you know, some kind of mechanical interaction with it. So yeah, that's a generous way to put it if I were to say that, but I can definitely see the utility in that.
This would be jumping off a little bit of the theme question, but how do you decide what the length of your game will be? And Dicey, you're already in the middle of this, but like, I don't know how much you can answer, but like, do you go by feeling, or is it by budget, like what you can conceivably do?
No, you go.
I think the game dictates how long it wants to be. I think like the game, based on like the decisions you make early on, and like the, you know, as well as the genre and like the categories and the theme that your game falls into, like I think they tell you usually pretty early on like how reasonable it would be for you to make this like a kind of complete experience. And if you try to add a lot more, or if you try to not add enough, it's usually pretty obvious, or at least I find it's usually obvious when you're like, this is not working, or I'm like really stretching myself or spreading myself thin to make this work. And so, you know, that's why I ended up with a pretty short game, because the like quality bar that I had set for the levels and the kind of like rules that I had set early on about how deep, you know, the like, you know, what the control scheme is, and, you know, how, what the affordances are, and like, oh, it's on these multiple platforms and it's for kids, and all this stuff kind of dictated like, oh, you know, I think I've kind of, I wish, you know, maybe I could have added a few more levels, and if I had more time, I probably would have tried, but it was kind of clear that like, oh, I can see the limit of how much this game needs if I want to have all the elements I'm juggling right now. So like, that's what told me, you know, the story should be this long. This is the how many levels I'm going to have. And I felt like I didn't have much of a choice in that, you know, beyond, you know, the first 2 years of working on it.
And you were still introducing mechanics like 3/4 of the way through, I felt like. It was like the last mechanic you introduced, the drinking bird?
No, that was early on. There was like, you can launch stuff out of the hole halfway through. But yeah, it's funny, like the launching out of the hole was actually the second level in the prototype, and it was supposed to be a game all about that. And then, you know, with all the constraints I had put on myself, and, you know, the way the camera worked, and, you know, the way it's all based on physics, like I hit a wall with that mechanic, and I was like, oh, okay, I need to retool like the arc of this game to make it match, you know, the like the feeling and the complexity that I want. So I ended up putting it halfway through, and I kind of wish I got more levels into it, but we're using that mechanic, but I feel like in service of the story, it was like enough.
Yeah. Has this been like your experience too, Dicey?
Not really. I think that I have a lot of, I guess, like self-doubt about video games and or this game and its length. Like, I don't know about you, Ben, but that pressure of, it's not long enough, or the other side of that, oh, it doesn't respect your time. those are, you know, those are things that weigh on me a lot. And so, especially in a game that is supposed to feel like, you know, it could go on forever, and, you know, what sorts of secrets are hidden in this thing? It could contain anything. Like a game that's supposed to evoke that feeling, or at least something that started out with that, with wanting to feel that way, is, you know, it's going to run into the harsh realities of, no, you need to make all that content. And far and away, the thing that I've discovered is most challenging for me to do is produce content. And that sounds silly, like, isn't that what the game is? It's content. But it's like the thing we were talking about before, it's, I, you know, like, making, polishing details is like the most wonderful thing in the world, like, second only to snacks and cleaning. Making details is fun, because you are looking at something and saying, that's pretty good, but I can make it better. And you look at it and it's better, and you get satisfied. Making content is looking at something and making a crappy version of it and getting depressed about it and saying, this only serves to highlight all the problems. What if I solved it this way? That would require me redoing a bunch of stuff, but sure, I'll do that. And anyway, it's just that's one of those vortices that you can get into. So, I don't exactly know how long this game is going to be, and I have anxiety about that. But I think in this case, the game telling you how long it's going to be is just the process of it sort of like annealing over the course of development, and sort of, yeah, or like crystallizing, I guess, slowly, you know, all those tiny decisions that get made over the course of, you know, 3.5 years now start to, you know, slot it into a particular range. And I guess also the understanding that, you know, it's an indie game, and it's going to have like, there are certain expectations about how long something is going to help inform that a little bit, I think. But it's a point of stress for sure.
Yeah, it's something I stressed about for sure.
Yeah.
When did you think you had the length decided, Ben?
Probably at least a year or 2 years before it was over. I knew how long it was going to be. And don't get me wrong, I wasn't like, oh yeah, this is perfect. Like, that's exactly the right length. Like, it's kind of like a running joke among like the Annapurna games that have been released so far, that they're all way too short, like, no matter how long they are. And I'm kind of getting to the point now with seeing like the reaction to Donut County, where I'm like a little bit, I kind of wish I could have made it a few hours longer. I don't think it would be possible, but I really wish I could, because the kind of like, I don't see any, I do see like some kind of, you know, like indie game aficionados being like, oh, that's perfect, I loved how short it was. But I feel like in general, the reaction is, Donut County, wow, really cool game. Just so you know, I need to tell you that I need to qualify this by saying it's a very short game. Like, I don't think anyone has said, I think there's not a single review that said it's a great game without saying it's too short. And so I'm like, wow, this is really interesting now, because like, I think I didn't meet people's expectations with what the game, like what the mechanics of the game would be. And, you know, I don't really regret what I did, but I feel like I really maybe should have been more cognizant of that kind of like gut reaction people have to it, and figured out a way to make less polished but more content that fits into the, like the overall structure, because it kind of like is driving me a little bit mad to see, like, if you Twitter search Donut County, you just see like, wow, Donut County, so awesome, really short, when is it going to get new levels? And I'm like, uh-oh, do you know how long it takes me to make a level, like a single level? Yeah. It takes no less than a month.
Do you notice if it's different? Are they the same like on consoles and on mobile? People saying that?
Oh, yeah. People say it on mobile as well because it's an expensive mobile game.
That's
it's
a whole
a $5
topic.
Mobile game. Yeah, it's a $5 mobile game.
When both of you, like, when you're playing games, do you often think about you wish the games were longer?
I don't know if I've ever felt that.
Yeah, I don't. I don't think so. There's a certain, you know, if you're investing yourself in characters and you feel like I want to hang out with these people forever. I want this game to be a million hours. I think that just means that for me at least, I will stop playing at some point. And it's rare to get the satisfying conclusion that shorter games can give. So yeah, I'm pro short game.
I'm kind of like, I find it kind of confusing because I don't finish basically any video game. And when you look at the statistics for most like achievements and stuff,
yeah,
like I don't think more than 30% of people complete any given game. So I find it kind of weird that like a short game that does end. Well, okay, maybe what's happening is like people are so used to having a game kind of stretch onto infinity because they quit.
Yeah.
When they play a short game and they see the ending, they're like, "Ew, it ended." Like, I wanted to be so exhausted that I stopped. But you're telling me it's over, and I wanted more. So, yeah, I feel like there's something to like finishing a game and being like, "Oh, there's so much more I could have done, but you know, I'm satisfied."
Yeah.
Have you looked at the achievements for Donut County? Like, have you seen how many people have beaten the game?
Oh, I actually haven't looked. I assumed mine would be like uncommonly high ratio, but I haven't looked. That would be really scary.
That would like prove your thesis that no one finishes games.
Well, I think people don't want to finish games. Like, they want to play till they're bored and know that they could come back because that means that their investment in this entertainment product was like worth it.
Yeah.
But if it gets exhausted and all the content is seen, then it's like, oh no, I can't use my toaster anymore. Like, imagine if you bought a toaster and you only had like 32 toasts and then it was done and you threw it out. You'd be like, that was a bad value.
To me, it's like, yeah, I'll buy this book and read half of it and then put it on the shelf and not really return to it for a while.
I mean, yeah, that does happen. But I think people like see video games as like, not as art in the same way like a book or a movie would be seen. Like people, like, I don't know, if you look at Steam reviews are obviously like a little bit biased towards a certain type of, you know, game consumer, but if you look, you can just see, if you just replace game with like toaster, it makes a lot more sense. You're just like, oh right, yeah, like they just wanted bang for their buck for the absolute cheapest they could pay, and they want as much content, as much time spent as possible. And so
not like, a good value for my time in this thing.
Yeah, right. Like literally I saw a Steam review today that was like, wow, really cool game, but not really worth it at full price, parentheses, $3. Like, wait for a sale. And I'm like, are you three? What? Like, how could you nitpick like anything under $5?
It's because every mobile game is 99 cents.
Or actually every mobile game's free.
Yeah, free. Yeah. Well, yeah, whatever.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not equipped to have that conversation because I'll just scream a lot, but
yeah, no, I mean, I think in general the response to my game has been really great, and I'm very grateful for the people who like got what I was doing and were happy with, you know, the whole package. But it does kind of bug me to see like the qualifier like being mandatory, like everyone has to say that it's short. I'm just like, whoa, you can't just say it's good. I don't know.
I just realized that we never asked this question on this podcast before, but how hard is it to name your game?
Uh-oh.
Dicey, you've named your game twice at least that we've known.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a journey.
I want to hear about it.
So it was originally called Secret Legend, which is a terrible name, and it was so terrible that it was sort of like a haha, this is what the Unity project folder is going to be called. No one would actually call their video game that. But deep down, like, that's what I said. But deep down, I was like, oh, it's sort of, you know, I like it. Captures the feeling a little bit. But it became more and more obvious as time went on that it was the worst name for anything that any human had ever come up with, at least for a commercial project, because it was at PAX under that name, and people would come up to the booth and play it and be like, oh, this is awesome, this is great. And they'd walk away and be like, yeah, that Secret of Legend of something. It was the Fox game. And so that as well as a few other things meant that it had to change. And strangely enough, SEO on it, like search engine results for it, was surprisingly good. I guess no one had put those two, you know, deeply related words right next to one another, or at least we won that fight. But human beings, on the other hand, had a real hard time. It was like Teflon to memory. But so then there was an enormous doc, like a shared doc between me and Felix and Adam, that was Secret Legend is a bad name. And it was full of a bunch of ideas. And Tunic, which is the new name, was in there as sort of like in one of the like torrents of ideas that we had. It just got thrown in there. And it took a little bit of time before, you know, we revisited and we're like, actually, you know what? This one's pretty good. And yeah, it's sort of like everything. And this lines up with the advice that I got, because I asked people at this time, like other developers, how do you name things? And the advice that I heard over and over again was just find something that nobody really hates and that you can get the domain for. And the conversation got on, like, well, we don't hate it, and it actually has some cool sort of secret significance. Oh, yeah, let's do it. And I think this is kind of a theme in this conversation. The constraint was there was a deadline. Like, we were going to be showing at a big thing where it was going to be part of a stage show, and we needed to have a title for the game so we could put like a title card or whatever in it, and not, you know, because if we use the old name, then we would be sort of blowing this marketing opportunity, because people would now have this, you know, stupid Teflon name on it, and it wouldn't be worth anything. We needed the actual name, and it was that deadline that made things happen.
That's beautiful. Yeah, my like technique for naming stuff is that it has to have obviously not been used before, but also seem so obvious that everyone wonders why that wasn't the name of something already. Like, I think that's like the most successful titles, because it's like, because I don't know, like anything in making art or making video games, like, every part of it, like choosing the title, is both the most important and absolutely the least important thing you'll do on the project. Like, it could be the same game, and it's like, yeah, it kind of doesn't matter, but it also can change everything. So it's like, I don't know, it's hard to decide, but I definitely found like picking something that is really familiar, but mostly familiar, but a tiny bit new, and feels like it was already a thing, kind of like justifies the product in itself, because someone can hear it and be like, oh yeah, that's a real thing. I believe that's a real video game.
That sounds like a video game. Gone are the days where you could just call your game like combat or golf and that was okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Has there been a game called golf?
Yes.
There has to
be. I'm pretty sure, yeah. Was Donut County called anything else before Donut County?
Well, there was like the... When I rethemed it, I had like a huge list of names that were all pretty terrible. So like, I don't think any of them... I don't have any of them that I was like deciding between. I think it was kind of like at once. I was under the same kind of time pressure, so I had to come up with something. And I think I was leaning towards like making it about a donut shop. And there were so many things to like figure out beyond that in terms of the like content and the story, that I was like, you know what? Donut County asks so many questions that would be kind of fun to answer, that I think that would be like the way to go. And it's kind of like familiar, but a little bit different. One of the big problems with the name itself is that, well, it's got two problems. Each word is a bad word to pick for a title because there's two ways to spell donut. I chose the Simpsons way. And then nothing is called county. And so everyone thinks it's country because of Donkey Kong Country.
Wow. Weird. I did not think of that.
Oh, yeah. If you look up donut country, you see lots of people just talking about Donut County and not even thinking about it. So I'm like,
in the future, they're playing the sequel. Yeah, it has to be the sequel then. That's how you capitalize on that.
I mean, yeah, I already got people talking about it.
Yeah. I'll go through a couple of other questions while we have time. How do you maintain a good work-life balance when your boss is pretty much just you? Ben, I assume, like, working outside of your house at, like, a place where there's other people around and seeing them go home, I assume that helps.
Oh, yeah. Definitely having, like, regular hours is the only way I think it's possible. Like, I don't know. I know some people kind of work on and off throughout the day, but I really like just being able to turn it on and turn it off. And I know some people like work kind of like obsessively, like they'll work 7 days a week on their game to try to get it done or to make it as good as they can make it. But that's just not possible for me. I don't have that motivation that motivation doesn't last beyond like a week for me. Yeah. Like after that, I'm just like, oh no, I never want to touch this again. So the only choice I have is to just work regularly. Maybe it's because I worked on it so long that like once I'm in year six, I'm just like, well, this is my day job and it has been forever for my like adult life. So I have to just do it at regular times. And then, you know, I get to think about other things when I'm done. So that's I don't know. I never like pulled a single all-nighter working on this game.
Good for you. Yeah, good job.
But I mean, I would just like, I don't know what would have happened. It wouldn't have amounted to anything if I did. So it's just out of necessity.
How about you, Andrew?
I think sort of similar. Like I said, I do like a time log thing to see where all my time is going and also to sort of like put my brain into work mode. And having weekly meetings where it's sort of like, oh, I need to get stuff done. And I said I was going to get this done, so I'm going to work on this helps as well. But although I will sometimes work on the weekends if I'm, you know, either really excited about something or feel like I'm super behind, I'm usually pretty good about, you know, making sure that I am doing things that aren't work. I'm always fretting about it, but
yeah,
maybe
that
I'm
never
not,
turns off.
Yeah, you know, and anytime you see something that is like tangentially related in the tiniest way, you're like, oh my god, I need to like write this down, or you know, now you're thinking about work again. But I have not gotten into the work all night thing. Like my just brain turns into a pumpkin at 8 p.m. and I can't do anything. That I think part of it is feeling like I'm doing a bad job. I get real like self-loathy when I'm sleepy, and so it's just like, this can't be my best possible self. You know, I'll wake up early tomorrow and take a crack at this and I'll be better at it. So that has hopefully saved me some sleepless nights.
Yeah, I feel that way too. I feel like the day is just a gradient of like how, not talented, but like how much I can really accomplish, like how difficult a task I can accomplish. So like, yeah. I can only do something difficult if I start it in the morning. And if I start it at night, then I'm literally wasting all my time.
Yeah, you'll wake up in the morning and realize not only did you do this, did you lose some sleep because you're working on it late, but you did it in like a bad way. Like you actually, right. This is more work to undo, or you're just going to have to throw it all away.
That's very related.
I asked, just, you know, like informally Twitter the other day, you know, are there other people out there that use timekeeping? Like I use something that's called, or a variant of something called Pomodoro, where you work for about 25 minutes and then you take a little break. I don't actually follow that super strictly, but that's where it started. And I asked, how much time do you spend with like real nose down? Like I am working with little to no interruption on a task. Like how much time, because, you know, traditional work days, whatever, 8 hours, but it's like rarely more than half of that. Like usually way less than half is actually time that you're working on a task, at least for the informal survey that I took. Like, and for me, that's basically the same thing. Like if you can get 8 25-minute chunks of solid work done in a day, like, great, like, you are doing just fine, or at least that's the metric that I use for myself.
That's really nice. Yeah, I definitely find that too. It's like, well, I find, like, if I am super focused and excited about something, I do not need any timing technique at all. But the second it's, like, really challenging, or, like, I have failed once at this before, I have to have a timer running to, like, mm-hmm. keep me from eating snacks.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, yeah. But, like, yeah, at the end of the day, I'm like, well, how much work did I really do? Like, 3 hours? Like, even 3 hours of solid work is, like, amazing.
Yeah, totally. I find that it's actually useful in both cases. One is to help you, like, you could look at it and be like, gosh, it's 2 p.m. and I haven't actually done that much work today, and I'm supposed to, I really need to, like, do the hard work that I've been putting off. But on the other hand, it could be, you know, 2 p.m. and you're like, gosh, I got stuck doing this one weird polish thing all morning, and I've just, like, I've met my quota already. That's probably actually a bad sign. That probably means that I got stuck in that trance-like state where you're trying to iterate on something and make it better, and you end up stumbling away from it, and you're like, I have sort of, like, drained myself a little bit for, you know, like, questionable benefit, who knows, like,
right,
you know, yeah. Fiddling with the IK blending on these feet for 2 days, like, no, that's bad, you should move on, like, don't that's good enough.
This is going way back to Dicey. You're talking about hiding your narrative in your game and the story in parts of the world for people to poke around and stuff. And Ben, if you have thoughts, I'd love to hear them. But how do you decide what to hide of your story? And, like, when do you know something is too easy to find or too hard?
That is a good question. And I don't necessarily know the answer, because the game isn't out yet. I don't mean that to be cute. I mean that it is still something that I struggle with, is knowing, wait, is this too obscure? Is this too obvious? And I think where I've settled is that I'm going to not worry about it too hard, because it's a game that is ideally supposed to evoke a feeling of actual discovery as you move around. And inherently, by not having very much text in the game that you can read, I'm hoping that will help promote that feeling of discovery. And if something is super obscure, that's okay. For the people that do find it, that's great. Good job. And for the people that don't, that's also okay, because I think there's a certain amount of, like, ambient, like, mystery radiation that comes off of a secret that's really deeply hidden, that just gets interpreted by humans as, like, gosh, there's something weird that I don't understand over there. And that's okay. Like, yeah, I'm okay with any given person not wringing the game dry. You know, it's, you know, part of feeling like you actually discovered something when you find it is it being the sort of thing that you could have missed, and that maybe other people did miss.
Ben, I think for you, or at least what I think of for Don County, the stuff you've hidden is the achievements and the hidden stuff in there of, like, oh, I just did this one random thing and I got an achievement for it, like tapping the tweet button 100 times or however many times it was.
Uh-huh.
How do you decide what stuff to do with that?
Well, I think, yeah, no, that's a good question. Like, I think in my case, I made a very linear game. Like, there's not a huge possibility space for you to miss things. And so in my case, it was a matter of, in terms of, like, actual secrets, it was just a matter of watching people play it and seeing when people, like, were trying something that they knew probably wouldn't do anything, and making those people feel clever. So, like, I kind of reverse engineered it. It wasn't, like, a secret to begin with. Yeah. It was, like, I saw people would do that, and it was, like, a small enough amount of people that, like, who would be really excited if they got some kind of feedback from that. And so that's what kind of dictated, like, oh, right, these are the types of actions I should reward if people are kind of seeking the edges of the systems and stuff. So, like, anytime there was something that people would do and be like, huh, okay, I guess that didn't do anything, I tried to, like, have some kind of feedback back for them.
Awesome. And then my last question, since we started with Twitter, we're going to end with Twitter. And how do you do Twitter well? Because for better or worse, it's become, like, maintaining a social media presence has become part of game development and marketing, especially if you're not AAA and trying to get your stuff out there.
I used to have fun on Twitter. years ago, I had a lot of fun on Twitter writing stuff. and it was great. And I would deliberately not show my work because I didn't want people to get exhausted of it. And I just emotionally couldn't handle showing it. So instead, I just tried to write entertaining things. And I had a blast. And there were other people doing that. And now there isn't, for some reason. And I have, like, recently, like, near the end of development of my game, I just stopped using Twitter because it was taking up a lot of my day. And it was, like, causing my emotional state to, like, swing rapidly for no reason and for no benefit. And so I was like, okay, let me just not use this. And so I haven't really fully gotten back to it. I'll, like, check it a little bit, but I don't really, I haven't tweeted in a while, and I feel this kind of pull, like this need to do it so that people know I exist and I'm alive, because I've definitely gotten benefits from being on there. But I actually don't know how to interact with it now, because my kind of like preferred mode of just absurdity has given way to like lots of other discourse that I'm not interested in. I'll put it that way. And I don't like memes and I don't like puns, so I'm kind of screwed.
You don't like puns?
I really don't. Donut County has like no puns in it. And I feel like I pay a humor tax for that because like people absolutely love puns. And even people who like don't have a sense of humor can appreciate a pun because it's like procedural humor. So like they can sense that, they can see like, oh, that's like a structural joke. And
it's just like, I better laugh at it so people don't think I'm a robot.
It dictates that you should laugh, or it dictates actually that you should be mad that someone did it, or you should groan. But I don't know, I just, it's not for me, so I have no puns in the
sounds
game.
Sounds like a back of the box quote, or like a nice shiny badge on the front of it. It's like 100% pun free.
I should get an achievement. I should get like a platinum trophy for that. Because I don't think it actually makes people think the game's better or funnier or, you know, well-written. I just kind of pay tax on my personal sense of humor. For my personal sense of humor. But that's fine.
You had more puns be longer.
You're right, yeah.
That's more angry about.
I could increase the size of the game.
Maybe that's another design constraint. It's like, what sort of game could you make if you wanted to make a game about putting everything into a hole and also there are no puns?
That was my design document.
Yeah.
What about you, Andrew? How do you do Twitter well?
I'm bad at it, I think. So I don't have any like hot tips on how to be cool on Twitter. The interest in the game like certainly started on Twitter. Like I showed little GIFs or I guess Vines at the time, RIP, and people got really excited about it. And then over the years, it's gotten to a point where it's like, I would like to share more of the stuff that I've been working on, but it's either like a secret or it's just crappy looking. Like there's only so like, hey, I can show people what it's like to gray box an area, but you know, it's sort of like the adding particles beneath your feet when you run around. Like I deliberately stop myself from adding polish in certain cases. If I know like, oh no, I know that I can add blades of grass to this and like do texturing. I can do that later. I don't need to worry about it. I've got bigger fish to fry. But if you're going to put something in the internet, they want to see fried fish, right? They want to see something that looks cool. But anyway, I hopefully there will be more coming from the official Tunic Game Twitter account, because I actually was talking to Harris from Finji and Felix, and we've got plans for ways to show things that aren't like super secret and just, you know, like you said, remind people that this product exists.
That's nice.
We'll end on that tantalizing tidbit. Speaking of Twitter, where can people find you two on the internet?
I'm at Dicey, D-I-C-E-Y, or you can follow, more importantly, Tunic Game on Twitter.
And I am on Twitter as Torahorse, T-O-R-A-H, horse. My website's torahorse.com if you want to see my other work, play some other games. And there is a Donut County Twitter account at Donut County, which is going to have news about like when we do a merch store and any future platforms and stuff like that.
Yeah, you can find this podcast at Script Podcast. Leave us a review at iTunes if you feel so inclined. Thank you, too, for coming on today. Yeah, this is great.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was great. Super fun.